Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. More than a decade ago, Oregon began putting laws on the books to limit global warming pollution. But every time a bill is proposed to cap carbon emissions while growing a clean economy and job market, it has been blocked by major polluters' clout. This year, the state legislature is once again considering a clean energy jobs bill, and this time it appears likely to pass. But it could still be significantly weakened during the upcoming legislative session. Today we talk with Damon Mott-Story, clean energy organizer for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Dr. Pat DeLaQuille with 350 PDX about the pros and cons of this proposed legislation, how it can be strengthened, and how it needs to fend off challenges from fossil fuel and other industry lobbyists. Pat, welcome to Locus Focus, and Damon, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start by just talking about how you both have come into this struggle from your different perspectives. So we'll start with you, Damon, since you were just here just a few months ago doing something not that different from what we're going to be talking about today.
That's right. I was here the day before Election Day speaking with you about the Portland Clean Energy Initiative. And my goodness, how wonderful to see that that passed by 65%. So I'll talk a little bit about what led me to be a part of this work. I grew up in Colorado in the mountains. It was just glorious and beautiful. And I, you know, remember running around in the backyard and just enjoying the natural splendor and everything like that. And my parents were telling me about climate change back then and how big of an issue it was. And I really felt that that was going to be one of the major issues of my time. And I went vegetarian at age 10 after hearing how much that would reduce my own personal carbon footprint. And when I was in college and I was lobbying during the Obama administration for a carbon tax, and boy, that seems like a really different era than when we thought that sort of thing might be possible on a federal level. That's kind of, you know, sort of some of my lead up and background. And then I moved to Oregon to work for Physicians for Social Responsibility because I really believe in this incredible theory of change that, you know, doctors and nurses and other health professionals that are so trusted, are telling us all that this is one of the greatest existential issues of our time, that this is one of the largest public health crises we've ever seen as a society, as a humanity.
Well, actually, when I was first starting doing my radio work, I was working a lot with Physicians for Social Responsibility. In those days, we were talking about nuclear war. And I have had some interesting conversations with PSR people about how the equivalence of dealing with nuclear war and with climate change, and in some ways, maybe climate change is even a greater existential threat than nuclear war, because nuclear war was something we could actually prevent.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd posit that if we do the right thing and we play our cards right, we can prevent the worst scenarios of climate change, too, I hope.
Well, one interesting thing, like in talking to you, and you're describing growing up with the specter of climate change, basically this has colored your entire life because you're not that old, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just want to kind of get a comment from you about looking at me and Pat here. We're a different generation where climate change is something that, actually, they were talking about it when I was in my early 20s. So, I mean, it's been a long time. But certainly it wasn't something that was a shadow over our entire lives. Mm. And I wonder if that has also been stimulus for you to really get engaged in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say it's been hard because I remember hearing that we needed to take rapid action 15 years ago, 20 years ago. You know, this sort of thing is not new. So it's been, I think, frustrating. And I think a lot of millennials can relate to this. So this feeling of growing up, knowing about this major issue and, you know, fast forwarding a decade or two later, to find that we haven't really made the substantial progress that scientists say that we need, you know, so it's a little bizarre to be thinking about, you know, am I going to try to buy a house? Am I going to try to have a family? And how does that all intersect with the way that the world is changing? And, you know, what can we actually do something about it? Because there's been so much inaction for so long.
Well, Pat, you were doing this work before Damon was even born. Is that correct?
Yes, I grew up in the 50s and 60s in western Pennsylvania in strip mining country. And I've hated the coal industry ever since. You know, I studied nuclear engineering and thought that was going to be the wave of the future, but that didn't really quite pan out the way we had hoped it would for a lot of different reasons. But, you know, I started working in the renewable energy field in 1980, started commercializing, concentrating solar and photovoltaic solar energy systems at Sandia National Labs. I moved on to manage Bechtel's activity to, we built projects, early projects in the 80s, like PV USA, which was the first utility scale test bed for photovoltaic systems and the solar to power tower and a number of other types of studies, and to move that field of renewable energy from its infancy into a real commercial force. And then I moved on to the international community and started working on small-scale renewables in developing countries, looking at ways to commercialize those technologies based upon, you know, Western technology, but indigenous, you know, support systems and manufacturing systems. And now I do energy systems modeling and analysis. I look at national energy systems. I design least cost optimization models to try to figure out what's the most cost-effective policy for combating climate change. You know, I first learned of climate change in the early 70s when I was at MIT, and, you know, it was the threat that we knew was coming, but now it's upon us. It's staring down our necks, and we need to do something dramatic. And it's, you know, I'm very encouraged these days. I know that it can feel very, very depressing for young people today to look at a world that doesn't feel hopeful. When I grew up, the world was full of hope and progress. And today we see doom and gloom in many places, and a dysfunctional government, and so many issues that, you know, trace their sources back to money. But climate change is something that if we're smart about it, we can transition to a clean energy economy that will create more jobs and economic development than a business as usual pathway. And if this is a smart thing to do, but there are strong, powerful interests who don't want to see this happen because they feel threatened. And I don't think there's any compromise. There has to be a full, full court press to make the changes that we need to bring about a more just and equitable society that addresses the issues of people, not just climate change, but many other issues that we face.
Well, you mentioned that you were on the trajectory to be a nuclear engineer. Actually, reminds me, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a nuclear physicist.
Oh, I am a nuclear engineer.
You are.
I have a PhD in nuclear engineering.
Well, I am not a nuclear physicist. Didn't turn out that way. But I remember very strongly because we were probably children around the same time, the big promotion of nuclear power as the panacea, that this was going to be the energy too cheap to meter. And it had a lot of government subsidy. I'd say after the Manhattan Project, it was probably the biggest push. Well, maybe that in the space program, you know, where the government really was pushing this technology. Why don't we have that same push for renewables today?
It doesn't fit into the mindset of people who some of the industries that see it as the future. I mean, back in the 70s, all of the oil companies got into solar power because they were of the paradigm that they were going to transition to energy companies. But when oil prices collapsed in the 80s, and this idea of shareholder value began to take over the mindset of our corporations, they all pulled out and said, we're just going to focus on our core business. They invested in lots of assets in the ground, which they want to profit on, but we can't let them. There's much more, you know, fossil fuel in the ground than we can afford to burn, mm-hmm. and still maintain our global civilization.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is very interesting about what you're saying, Barbara, is that, you know, solar, especially rooftop solar, has this incredible potential to change not only how we generate our electricity, but where we generate our electricity.
And who profits or doesn't profit.
Exactly, right. And so when we get into conversations about energy mm-hmm. democracy and really changing the structures of how we generate energy and get energy to the people who need it, you know, renewables, especially small-scale distributed ones, have this amazing opportunity to empower communities and disrupt the whole paradigm on how we've been doing this shareholder profit model that you're talking about, Pat.
Well, I was also thinking mm-hmm. back, Pat, when you and I were kids, I don't know if your school system showed these movies. There were these movies that Bell Telephone made. That's the precursor mm-hmm. for AT&T now, I guess. And they... There was one in particular that I loved called Our Mr. Sun, and it was all about the sun. It was all very about astronomy until the end. And at the end, they talked about how we were going to be running out of oil and we needed to transition to solar power. And these mm-hmm. pictures of those early gawky yeah. solar arrays, and I looked at them as a 8 or 10-year-old and went, I wouldn't want one of those in my house. They're really ugly. But I was feeling, when I saw that movie, almost this chill of like, I mean, because it was pointing us into a future that made me a little uncertain, and this is back like in 1958 or something, that that we had to think past fossil fuels. And I find it interesting to think that that's what Bell Telephone was pushing in the 50s and early 60s, and that there was a belief somewhere, I mean, they're showing this to school kids, that we really had to think in terms of how do we transition to solar energy. And also, I remember in that movie, it made solar energy seem so logical and so accessible and so reasonable.
No, it is. It is. And it's making a huge difference in many, many countries. I mean, Bangladesh has somewhere between 5 and 6 million solar home systems in a country that has less than 50% of the population connected to the grid. So there has been progress, but nowhere near enough progress as we need.
Yeah. Well, let's start talking about what's facing the Oregon legislature this session. There's this bill called HB 2020. And I know you guys have, I'm not sure how different your perspectives on it, but definitely different perspectives on this bill. And I want to start with Pat, who wrote a paper which is pretty much supporting this. And then we'll get to you, Damon, about, you know, what some of your criticisms are. But in a nutshell, Pat, what is this bill and why are you behind it?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, this bill is a part of a series of steps that that many of us in the community have been making over many years to put together a framework of climate legislation that started off with the renewable portfolio standard, where we now have a requirement for utilities to have 50% of their electricity generated by solar or wind and other renewables by 2040, I believe. We have a clean fuels bill. We have a coal to clean bill, which is going to phase out coal by 2030. And so these are all parts of a strategy that really needs to have other components to it, including agriculture and transportation. But the Clean Energy Jobs Bill, or this Cap and Invest Bill, is the centerpiece of this framework because it provides the legally binding cap on greenhouse gas emissions that will decline by, you know, from 1990 levels to 45% below by 2035 is what's in the current bill, and 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. Now, I personally don't believe those are strong enough, but these are goals that have been hard fought to maintain in the bill, especially the 2035 goal, which I believe is most important, and the 2050 goal. We still have time to make corrections there. So the 2035 goal is what we're really trying to hold on to and even strengthen that if we can, because industry is working very hard to weaken that. Can I finish?
Sure, yeah.
Because the cap is the first half of the bill. It's the stick, so to speak. And the market is the carrot. The market is what allows individual businesses to trade their share of allowances or whatever allowances they have back and forth, because company A may already be a little bit more efficient, and they're going to do an efficiency project this year, was already planned, so their emissions are going to be lower than what they expect. But company B may be in a position where they aren't quite ready. They need a couple years to get the design work and other things done to figure out how they can make a process improvements or energy efficiency improvements in their plant. So this gives flexibility to make sure that companies can plan ahead and can do these investments in a stable way according to their own business plans. Because these are investments. You'll hear industry talk about, oh, it's going to cost us a fortune, but it's going to cost them investing in energy efficiency and renewable energy, which is going to pay back in lower fuel costs within 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Damon Mott-Sturry, clean energy organizer for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Pat DeLaQuille, who you just heard, who's with 350 PDX, and we're talking about Oregon's Clean Energy Jobs Bill, HB 2020, which is being debated right now. Well, you talk about the cap, and this is something that it seems to be quite controversial and has been for years and also really misunderstood. And I've done several shows about cap and trade. I've also had people on the show different times talking about how that's just a capitalist ploy. So I want to get into why, because a lot of people I have a lot of respect for really support cap and trade. And I want to have you, and I want to get you in this too, Damon, why do you think that this is an effective tool, if not a necessary tool, to move us towards climate justice, basically?
So, excuse me. I want to start by saying that I think the cap is a fabulous idea, right? Like, I think that that's an important way to frame it. And one of the big successes of this bill draft is that the cap is sector wide, right? Like, it doesn't matter who you are or how you're emitting carbon, but this cap is about our overall emissions as a state and bringing those down to a reasonable level. As Pat was saying, I think it'd be good to get these caps even more ambitious than they currently are, because as we know, we only have less than 12 years to make a really significant move on climate action in order to avert the sort of worst case scenarios of climate change. And then sort of the devil is in the details, right? You know, a lot of the allowance portion of this, you know, where how you actually get a permit to pollute, it can be really opened up for a lot of manipulation. And the bill as it currently stands has a lot of different exemptions for industries that have a really big greenhouse gas warming potential. Things like fluorinated gas, incineration of waste. There's a lot of different things that that really should be improved in the sort of the nitty-gritties of the bill.
So, Pat, I mean, I know you also have criticisms of it, mm-hmm. but how do yours kind of compare with Damon's, I'm wondering?
Well, first of all, I mean, I see the market as a compliance mechanism. The market is not something that's going to be driven by Wall Street. It's not something that's going to be open to a lot of speculation, especially if we keep it contained here in Oregon. I think that, the issues of strengthening the bill are very important, and we have a number of issues that we want to see strengthened in the bill. I think the exemptions is clearly one of them. We don't want to see exemptions for the semiconductor industry. We don't want to see exemptions for municipal solid waste. We don't want to see too many free allowances. I mean, right now, the utility...
Okay. I define free allowance.
Okay. So there's... The way this market works is that the state goes to auction once a quarter, and it provides a certain number of allowances that are within the total of the cap for sale. Okay, but some of them they will consign to different entities based upon certain criteria that they may meet. So electric utilities right now, because they've already made investments in the RPS, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and the Coal to Clean bill, are asking for 100% free allowance. Actually, the bill gives them 100% free allowance.
Now, what does it mean that they have 100% free allowance?
Well, that means that they would get from the state the number of allowances that they need to turn in every year to cover their projected emissions. So if their projected emissions is 2 million tons, they would get 2 million tons worth of allowances that they could then turn in to cover their portion of the emissions under the cap.
Without
having to pay for it. So it reduces compliance costs and it prevents things like electricity prices going up that would impact poor communities. So there is an argument to be made for that, but we don't think 100% is justifiable given what they've done with RPS and Coal to Clean. I would think maybe 75% free allowances would be a fairer share for them, because they need to have some ambition as well and some skin in the game to continue to make further reductions. The other component that people talk a lot about are these export, energy intensive trade exposed industries, that if they lose market share and those products, whether it be cement or plastics or whatever, comes from another state that doesn't have the same requirements for reducing emissions, then that those emissions just go somewhere else. And we don't get those reductions here in Oregon or anywhere. So there is an argument to be made for, again, giving those entities free allowances, which means they still have to reduce under the cap, because that cap goes down every year and they're going to have to reduce emissions, but they don't have to pay the full pollution cost. They only have to pay a portion of that. And it's a complicated, wonky thing, but their allowances would be based upon the average emissions for the sector. So you may have five or six companies in Oregon that make paper or whatever, or cement. And you look at the average for all of those and you say, all right, right now the bill says 100% of that average will give you. So if you're below average, you get a little benefit. If you're above average, you have to pay more. We would like to see that at 80 or 90% of the average, because again, we want to show that you know, there's more ambition here, there's more requirement to make reductions, and that there should be more incentive, because what requiring them to pay for some allowances means that their energy efficiency and renewable energy projects will be that much more cost effective. Instead of a 5-year payback, it might only be a 3-year payback. And we want people to move faster. We want them to move sooner rather than waiting till later.
Well, Damon, you're shaking your head. I mean, you're nodding your head. I just wonder, how much are you agreeing with this? And do you have other concerns that Pat maybe is not addressing?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, I think it's, you know, the bottom line really here is that you want the bill to be aggressive enough on greenhouse gas polluters that it makes it harder for them to continue polluting, right? But not so, you want to do it in such a way that they don't just move their pollution to somewhere with easier regulations, right? And so one of the other sides of this that also needs to be said is that when you give an allowance away for free, when the state decides to do that for one reason or another, very good or otherwise, that reduces the amount of revenue that the bill creates, right? And the reason why the bill is colloquially called Clean Energy Jobs is that the idea is all of the proceeds from this mechanism should be going towards investments in renewable energy mm-hmm. efficiency, job training, retraining workers from fossil fuel jobs into clean energy jobs. And that's all a really great idea. A lot of that really dovetails nicely with what Portland did with the Clean Energy Initiative here in November. And a lot of what I'm very focused on is, you know, how do we get a just and equitable and transparent bill that creates enough meaningful revenue to actually do a lot of clean energy and a lot of good.
How far do you feel like this bill in its current state is from what you'd like to see?
Pretty far.
And do you think you could change it in this session?
Well, that's we're really looking to our legislators to be bold here, because we now have, you know, super majorities of Democrats on both sides of the chamber, and we've really sent a strong message statewide that justice and equity issues are important from this past election. Mm-hmm. You know, the resounding no on Measure 105 to keep Oregon a sanctuary state, right, really shows people how much it's important to focus on environmental justice and on social justice in our state, right? And so I think that's giving us a good platform on which to tell legislators, the folks that are leading on this measure, that they can really be bold and they can go a lot further than they currently are going.
So I'm not that much of an expert on the legislative process, but I wonder, I mean, this bill has come... How far is it in its writing process right now? Is it actually something that's written and then it has to be amended or
yes.
revised?
Yeah, good question, actually. For the listeners paying attention to this, you have until this Friday to submit comments to the legislators on this bill draft. And we're, you know, encouraging everybody to submit comments in on, mm-hmm. you know, what do you like, what do you don't like, what would you like to see changed? Because all of that's going to go into this process of putting in amendments to make the bill hopefully stronger. And we need to really counter the fossil fuel interests that may want to seek even more exemptions.
Yes. So how do people find out enough about the bill so they can actually write coherent comments? Because that's a very daunting thing. You know, it's very easy to do these online petitions or online comments where it's all written out for you. And you just punch submit. But that's not what people should be doing. They should really be doing this themselves. So how do you, what kind of...
We've been putting out at 350 PDX, we've been putting out a lot of information to our membership with regards to what are the key things that we would like to see improved in the bill? And this is what the time to write your testimony, submit it to the Joint Committee and the legislatures. The title of the bill is HB 2020. You can find it on the Oregon Legislative Information System site. Just do a search for Clean Energy Jobs or HB 2020, Oregon CAP and Climate Action Program, which is the other name for the bill. Maybe I could just read, I mean, the key things that 350 PDX has identified that we would like to see strengthened in the bill is, one, we want to see a restoration of the percentage allocations for impacted communities. The bill in 2018 had very specific percentages for the climate investment fund, that 85% of the share would go to the investment fund and 15% would go to a just transition fund. And within those, within that 85% for the climate investment fund, 50% would go to impacted communities, 10% to tribes, 20% to working lands, and 20% general statewide activities. And we want to see those percentages put back in. We want to know that these monies are going to be spent in those impacted communities and not be just allocated by the legislature. We don't want any exemptions. This includes Jordan Cove. This includes marine and aviation fuels. This includes the semiconductor industry.
Right. Jordan Cove, let's get there for a second, because we've been talking a lot about this in the show. Why would they even be getting an exemption? That's what
I want
to know.
They don't. And then the bill currently has specifically says that there would be no exemption for new fossil fuel infrastructure. Okay, and we really need to have statewide a moratorium on fossil fuel infrastructure. We can't afford to build any more fossil fuel infrastructure. So we also want to make sure that we reduce the number of free allowances, both for the electric utilities, as I mentioned, 75% for the utilities, and the at no more than 90% for any one that is really classified as energy intensive, trade exposed. Okay, and that status needs to be scrutinized and reviewed every few years, because as other jurisdictions get on the same bandwagon and impose restrictions on greenhouse gas pollution, then that concern that there's going to be leakage begins to go away. By 2020, 25% of the world will have a price on carbon.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I got the impression that some of the companies that were being given 100% allowances were Northwest Natural Gas and Portland General Electric. Okay, not true. Okay.
Portland General Electric, yes, but not Northwest Natural Gas. The natural gas utilities get only the a percentage of free allowances in proportion to their low-income customer base, which was to protect the low-income customers.
Oh, in the case of PGE, why are they getting an allowance?
Because of their commitment to coal to clean and the renewable portfolio standard.
Okay, so my question that I'm going to keep pushing it, because PGE, yes, they said they were, you know, like the closing Boardman, really soon, like this year, next year. However, they were trying to build two new gas power plants.
That's right.
Not that long ago. So how do we trust PGE? And it seems like giving them 100% allowance for going coal to clean is not keeping their feet to the fire.
Yeah, but doesn't make sense.
But 100% free allowances, I mean, well, look, I don't agree with the 100%, but even at 100% level, those allowances decline every year. It's not as if that is going to allow them to pollute at the same level continuously. They still have to follow the cap, okay? So, yes, I think they need more. There needs to be more incentive for them to move more quickly towards more renewables, which is what not giving them 100% free allowances does. But it doesn't mean they'll reduce necessarily less. It means they'll reduce faster, I hope.
I think there is a risky loophole, however, in this bill, which is that in later on sections, it actually repeals an existing electric utility CO2 standard.
Yep.
And that would have made those CARDI generating station plants, it would have made them $17 million less expensive to build if there was no CO2 price on those new fracked gas power plants. And so this bill actually proposes giving a lot of free allowances to electric utilities while also eliminating the existing carbon price, although very low, on existing, fossil fuel electricity.
Yeah, that's another one of our hot button issues. We do not want to see that any rollback of those emissions standards, those siting standards.
Right.
So it looks to me like you guys are agreeing more than I was expecting you to.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I think this is not a perfect bill. And we have to recognize that politically, even though we have a Democratic supermajority on paper, we don't have a strong progressive Democratic majority, and that the Republicans are really working very hard to water this bill down. Industry is pushing very hard. And so we're not as strong politically as we really need to be. And I am encouraging our legislators to be as bold as possible. And I think that, they're going to step up to the plate. But I think that they're not going to come back with a home run, but we're not getting socks and underwear here. We're getting something that's going to be substantial, but it's not going to be good enough. and we're going to be coming back for more.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Damon Mott-Sturry, clean energy organizer for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Pat DeLaQuille with 350 PDX. We're talking about Oregon's Clean Energy Jobs Bill, HB 2020. Now, we were talking earlier about cap, and I threw out the term cap and trade. And I'm wondering, does this include cap and trade, or is this just cap?
Oh, no, no. This is a cap and trade bill.
So let's explain the trade part, because that's the other thing where people have, for years, criticized the trade part of cap and trade, thinking that it's a giant loophole, basically.
The trade is the same thing as the market that I explained earlier. It's a compliance mechanism. It allows companies that want to move fast to do that, and companies that need a few more years to get their act together to figure out what's the right process to do whatever technical studies that they need to do, because these are technical issues that have to be dealt with in a rigorous way. And so it gives them time. So trade is just to allow A, that moves fast, to sell some his surplus allowances to B, who's moving slowly, because it all starts when the state auctions off allowances. That's how the state gets the revenue that's going to be distributed through the Climate Investment Fund and the Transportation Decarbonization Account, et cetera. And the market is then simply between those independent entities that are covered that have allowances that either may have too much or not enough allowances. So it's not tied to Wall Street. It's not a market for speculation. It's a market for leveling out the individual choices that businesses have to make to meet the requirements of the cap.
Well, another controversial tool that's often used, and I think it's in part of this bill as well, is carbon offsets. Does this bill include carbon offsets, and what's your sense about that? Because I'm thinking most recently carbon offsets was a real flashpoint for the supplementary environmental impact statement for the methanol refinery in Kalama, because they're going to meet their carbon mitigation through offsets.
Right.
And people in the room's eyes were rolling.
This is a big environmental justice concern, and I'm glad you raised it. Not just the trading mechanism can mean that a big polluter can just continue to buy a whole lot of allowances in order to continue polluting in the neighborhoods and in the communities that are already very burdened by pollution. And the same thing is true of offsets. Currently, HB 2020 allows up to 8% of a compliance portfolio to be fulfilled through the use of carbon offsets. That might be planting trees in some place that then sequesters carbon in an amount equal to, however much is being emitted elsewhere. But that doesn't help the communities that are living right by that emission source. It doesn't help, the folks near major transportation corridors that are experiencing an enormous amount of immediate air toxic health impacts, as well as, the fact that carbon pollution is still going up into the greenhouse gas. So anyway, it's a big issue. We're hoping that number will come significantly down from 8%, because that's too much.
Well, I think that I remember reading in your paper, Pat, about, and I don't remember if this is part of the bill or something that you want to include in the bill, that offsets can't be used in communities that are being polluted, like, for instance, North Portland and the I-5 corridor.
No, that's one of the components of the bill right now, that it specifies that, first of all, any covered entity can only use up to 8%, according to the current writing of the bill, up to 8% of their total number of allowances that they have to turn in to cover their pollution. Only 8% of those can be from offsets, and so it is an increase in pollution. But yes, but the bill says they cannot, in any entity that is in a non-attainment air quality zone, cannot use offsets to offset any of its pollution. And so we're trying to avoid sacrifice zones by making sure that they cannot be used in those most affected communities. There's a flip side to this trading of the market, because yes, if you happen to be located next to company A, who's going to take 2 years to do their efficiency project, then you're going to have to live with that, like you've already been doing, for another couple of years. But I don't want to put that down at all. But I think there are always compromises that have to be made in any complex piece of legislature.
Well, that's something I think I'd like to get to now because I'm wondering, like, what makes this legislature, this legislative attempt more likely to pass than the bazillion ones that have failed over the last, I think that Oregon's been trying to pass a mm-hmm. bill like this for over 10 years. I just remember every legislative session, especially since the Democrats took back the legislature, we go in thinking, oh, we're going to get a clean energy job bill this time. And it doesn't even make it out of committee, and then doesn't get to a vote. And then I don't remember what happened last time. I guess last time it didn't get to be voted on either. So are there compromises in this one that are making it more likely to get passed?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's part of it, right? I think that, for example, the electric utilities have gotten a really good deal out of this, right? And they're not going to have to face very much paying of their pollution during the first 11 years of the bill, right? So that's I think, part of the reason why there's a little more impetus for it to pass. I think the other thing is that, you know, they've been hearing about this for long enough and are realizing how much of an important thing it is to take action on climate. And PSR really applauds that, right? Like, any efforts that are happening in the legislature to make a really significant dent on climate action is important. We just got to make sure we do it right and try to, you know, reduce any potential, you know, unintended consequences or harms that could come from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Oregonian ran an article a few days ago about how much money goes into the legislature that keeps good environmental acts from getting passed. I actually had some issues with that article because it seemed like it kind of whitewashed or greenwashed what's going on in Washington State, where I think they're having bigger problems than we are, actually, even if there's less campaign donations given to the politicians there. Well, but I wonder about, are you concerned that all this money that comes into the state legislature, particularly, well, actually, it turns out it's mostly timber, which is nothing new. That didn't have to be a groundbreaking story to tell for people to know that. But particularly with the fossil fuel industry, which I don't think it gives as much money in Oregon as it does to Washington. But is there enough there that could actually slow down this process and maybe derail it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a real concern, right? If you look at this Oregonian report called Polluted by Money, and you contrast that with David Roberts' article on California's cap and trade system, you see some really eerie parallels, because what David Roberts is basically arguing is that California's system was so impacted by the oil and gas industry that it may actually be too weak to do its job. So that's a real cautionary tale for us, right? And and looking at the enormous amount of corporate campaign contributions flooding into every single seat in the Oregon legislature, you know, it's not drawn across party lines. There's fossil fuel and dirty interests giving to Democrats, and they're giving to Republicans, and we're seeing a lot of, you know, bad impacts on our state because of it. So that's, I think it's a real cautionary tale, and that's why we need to demand that this bill, you know, not get any weaker and get a whole heck of a lot stronger.
Now, how would you compare this bill with what's been going on in the Washington legislature? Because, I mean, there's like three times where something has been put forward and has been derailed. And now, as Inslee is now declaring that he's running for president, he's also selling himself as the great climate champion, and that's his platform as president. And he's touts all his climate achievements in Washington State. And all I can think of, I know that they're there, but all I can think of is he supports LNG and methanol. So how do we kind of sort through all of that?
Well, we really need to focus here on Oregon. The reason we're going to have a bill this year is because of the hard work that's been gone in over the last 3 years. This bill has not been around for 10 years. This bill has only been around in its current form for 2 to 3 years at most, especially with the equity components that have been put into what would normally be a cap and trade bill. That's why we call it a cap and invest bill. The governor wants to sign it. We have a majority in the legislature in the Senate where we've had problems in the past. We had a joint committee formed by the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House that met all over the summer and took testimony on variety of details required to make sure this is going to be a strong bill. It's definitely not as strong as what we would like it to be. It definitely should be strengthened. And we need to show our legislators that we have the resolve that we're going to be watching what they do, and we're going to be holding them accountable. And we need a lot more politicking around this issue so that in the as we get closer to the 2020 election, that we're making sure that we can move into that election and get a fully progressive Democratic majority in our state legislature so that we can start to take even stronger action. But I think this is an important stepping stone, and it's not going to be perfect, but it's definitely going to be a very big step forward.
Well, and I'm glad you actually mentioned that, because no one single piece of climate policy is going to solve the enormously complex issue of climate change. And it's not even no one piece is even going to do enough to get Oregon to where it needs to be,
right.
Which is why it's very important for us to consistently send a very strong message to Governor Kate Brown. Mm-hmm. And this is where Washington also applies too, right? To both Governor Kate Brown and Governor Jay Inslee, that you must oppose major new fossil fuel infrastructure mm-hmm. like Jordan Cove, mm-hmm. like Kalama Methanol, like the Tacoma LNG facility, that you cannot call yourself a climate champion governor mm-hmm. and sit by quietly or passively, not touch talking about mm-hmm. those things. We need Kate Brown and Jay Inslee to oppose Jordan Cove, Klama, and the LNG facility in Tacoma.
Well, actually, yeah. I remember when after the Mosher oil train derailment happened, Jay Inslee made a really strong statement. Kate Brown's was not quite so strong. She seems mm-hmm. like she's gotten a little more teeth since then, and I'm wondering how far you think she can get pushed.
Well, activists throughout the state and concerned landowners, business owners, people from all over and especially in Southern Oregon have been talking to her for years about how she needs to stand up and take a leadership role on mm-hmm. Speaking out against the LNG pipeline and terminal proposed for Southern Oregon. And she's done nothing there. So that really that's a big problem. She really needs to take more of a leadership role there and listen to her constituents.
Well, I was talking to one of the landowners down in Southern Oregon who was telling me some theories that are floating around there about Kate Brown's future political trajectory. And because I thought once she was reelected as governor, now she doesn't have to worry about the unions and all that stuff. She can come forward and be really strong about frack gas. But she hasn't. And so I hadn't thought, she might have plans after she's governor where she wants to go next. And so that seems to be a really big concern, is how do we get these elected officials who want to continue rising in the ranks of political office, that they have to take these concerns as seriously as they take the concerns of some of their strong constituents like organized labor, which has a mixed track record on fossil fuel.
Yeah. And I would encourage Kate Brown to follow the mm-hmm. path of Jeff Merkley. He's a senator in Oregon, and he came out in opposition to the Jordan Cove LNG export project.
I'd like a lot of people to follow his lead.
Right. I would second that, too.
It's a pretty high elected office. So.
Was it create two, three, many Jeff Merkleys, I guess? Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Damon Watt-Story, clean energy organizer for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Dr. Pat DeLaQuille with 350 PDX. We're talking about Oregon's Clean Energy Jobs Bill, HB 2020. Damon, I'm kind of curious about how you think the success of the
Portland Clean Energy Initiative.
Right, that passed overwhelmingly mm-hmm. last fall. Actually, reverse results of Washington State's 1631 initiative, which was defeated 2-1. How do you think that initiative relates to the statewide initiative? What lessons can be learned from that? And do you think that there's ways of modeling what happened in Portland and have that work statewide?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question. I think one of the immediate first distinguishers that comes to my mind is that there's no exemptions on who pays for the Portland Clean Energy Initiative, right? It's just a 1% surcharge on all billion-dollar retailers doing business in our city, right? And so it's a very tight funding mechanism that is not open for any kind of leakage there. The other major difference here is that the Portland Clean Energy Initiative was crafted by and led by communities of color that were right on the ground with all sorts of different communities on the front lines of climate change. The bill that we're looking at right now was written by legislators, which is, that's fine. This is the Oregon legislature, right? But that's one of the major differences between a people's initiative and something that goes through the state legislature. And so it makes the onus and the impetus even stronger for those legislators to talk to environmental justice communities, to everybody who's most impacted directly by climate change, and hear what their impacts are and to incorporate that into any legislation they do. Yeah.
Well, speaking of initiatives, Pat, how do you think it compares to the failed Washington State initiative last fall, 1631?
Well, I think the most significant and important difference is that Portland as a community is very liberal, and Washington State, like Oregon State, is a mixed bag. And so success in Portland is because it's Portland and not because it can be passed in a larger community like Washington State. And so, you know, the initiative process is very expensive. It is not necessarily the best tool for a complicated technical issue of how to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. So, again, I think the legislative approach, while it's not perfect, and we did lose control. Last year, our consortium had control over the language of the bill, but this year we have not. And so there are definitely some weaknesses in the bill that have, compared to what it was in 2018, that we really want to have fixed. And that's where everyone can help, by making sure they put some pressure on their legislators to know that they're paying attention to this issue and they're going to vote on this issue.
Well,
One more quick note on Washington State while we're at it, by the way. The No on 1631 campaign raised $31 million and put that into their, scare tactics and things like that. So I think that's also an important point to bring up, right? There's a lot of rural Washingtonians mm-hmm. that really want to take bold action on climate change, but there were a lot of scare tactics out there and a lot of falsehoods that were spread by the oil and gas industry.
Mm-hmm. And I think money is much more effectively spent to really degrade an initiative process as opposed to the legislature. While we know there's still a lot of money, our legislators are accountable, and we know who they are, and we can put pressure on them if they don't do what we'd like.
Well, how do we counteract the pressure that's obviously being put on them by corporate interests that are going to have to pay in this bill?
Grassroots mobilization is the only thing that can counter money in politics. Yeah. We have to get people out.
There's two common wisdoms that I've heard, and one is that since this has never passed in Oregon before and 1631 was defeated, this current bill, 2020, is going to go down too. So I just wonder, I mean, I heard that actually on another public radio station not that long ago. Yeah. So what, I mean, is there any, should there be concern about that? I mean, lessons learned, or do you feel that there's such momentum for this that it will pass?
I think that the situation is different. Mm-hmm. I think that it is very likely that HB 2020 is going to pass, and that therefore it's all the more important that mm-hmm. we make sure it is done in a way that does not have harm on communities, right? So mm-hmm. What I would encourage all the listeners of today's program to do is, go to HB 2020 on the Oregon Legislative Information System, send in your comments to jccr.exhibits@oregonlegislature.gov, and call your legislators and let them know that what you want to see improved in this bill. You can, if you want some talking points, right. Oregon PSR is going to be sending an email alert out this week on that. So go to OregonPSR.org and sign up for our email list, and we'll help you out with some of your testimony.
Right. Well, I'm going to have links on the Locus Focus website, both for PSR and for 350. But Damon, if you could send me a link to the state, and then I'll put that on the website, and then people mm-hmm. can go directly there, right. since mm-hmm. it's hard to write all this information down.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So what are your hopes now? I mean, where do we go between now and when would this actually come up for a vote?
It's a good question. The legislature is a constantly, changing building, right? There's all sorts of different things, and deadlines are set and then they're changed and things like that. But I think we can probably expect that folks are going to try to put this for a vote in April. And this is the long legislative session, so they have until June, but there's a lot of other things on their plates. We're really encouraging folks to get in their comments on the mm-hmm. first draft by the end of this week. That's important. And then amendments will be written and discussed, and there will be opportunities for public comment at that point in the mm-hmm. stage as well before it goes to the Senate or the House floors.
Well, one last thing mm-hmm. that I've I've had some interesting conversations with friends, this is particularly around the Green New Deal, that there is concern about why are all these issues like environmental justice, like social justice, like immigration rights, why is this all thrown into legislation about climate change? And what are the connections? Because that's one of the ways that the New Green Deal is being debunked by its opponents, is that it's just all over the place. What's the connection between all this stuff? So why is this all connected, and why, and how do people make those arguments to their family and neighbors and other people that you might be finding that you're trying to convince about supporting 2020?
I'm glad you actually brought this up, because 350PDX and Oregon PSR are both signees on an Oregon Green New Deal platform. Mm-hmm. And it really, I think, nicely lays out some of the reasons for why social justice, immigration justice are critical, essential pieces of climate action. And so you can find that at the Oregon Just Transition Alliance's website. And yeah, I think for one thing as an example that comes off the top of my head is that, you know, Oregon is likely going to be a place that is continually inhabitable, even under the, you know, most dire scenarios of climate change. Other, you know, more coastal communities and places that are going to get unbearably hot, you know, folks may need to move to Oregon more than they currently are. And so it's important for us to have a welcoming attitude towards newcomers, because we're going to need to help each other out in a rapidly changing environment.
Pat, you have something to say?
I'm hopeful that we can continue to, you know, enact strong legislation in the areas where we still need action. We need action in our forestry and agricultural sectors. We need, I'd like to see, you know, the Highway Trust Fund turned into a public transit fund, or perhaps the transportation decarbonization account within this bill could be separated as a public transit type of fund. We need something like that in the state. We need to incentivize electric vehicles. We need to, you know, help our consumers along to make the smart choices to transition to a cleaner and more efficient world, which is what we need. And because many of these issues are connected, it's not, you know, money in politics does a whole range of things, including fund climate denial and fund politicians who are going to deny or obstruct climate justice, and the social issues are all interconnected. And I think that what the Green New Deal says to me is that we need to take a holistic approach. We need to look at all of these issues, and we need to find some common solutions that will change the fundamental nature of these issues and not just put a Band-Aid on them.
Well, I was thinking when you're talking about immigration, Damon, right after Trump was elected, I went to this meeting that 350 PDX put on, and there was a webinar that Bill McKibben was hosting. And I never saw Bill McKibben so quiet and so humble in a way. And basically what he was saying was our biggest concern right now is supporting the people who are going to be really attacked, under attack first, and it's immigrants. Mm. And I, similarly, like the same week, I interviewed Dan Sears for a documentary I was working on then. And turned out sort of like the story of his life, this documentary about fighting fossil fuel projects all around the region. And I asked him his response to Trump being elected, and he said a very similar thing. He said, I'm afraid about the environment, but first I'm afraid about people. We really need to take a stand to support the people that are going to be endangered. Mm-hmm. So I think something about Trump's election has kind of made us more aware of who the most vulnerable people are. So how does this initiative, how do we fit that framework into supporting this initiative?
To supporting particularly HB 2020.
Right. Well, when we're working on kind of Green New Deal kinds of things.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. Mm. I think, yeah, in working for a Green New Deal, anything that we do needs to put communities of color and working class people first, and make sure that all benefits go to them, right? Because we can transition to a renewable energy economy that replicates existing inequities, or we can do it in a way where the tide lifts all boats, right? So I think that's an important distinguisher there, and I'm glad you mentioned it.
Mm-hmm. And Pat, do you have any final comments?
Nope. I second what Damon just said. I think that, again, we're looking for We're looking for broader solutions here. We want a government that is going to be responsive to the needs of the people and not to the needs of the wealthy. And we need some fundamental changes to make that happen.
Well, I'm really glad to have you guys on today. And we maybe want to reconvene when this is actually going before the legislature. So maybe let's make a date in April.
That's a good idea.
After our pledge drive,
good
so we have a full hour to talk. Okay, well, thanks a whole lot for joining us today.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you, Barbara.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Barbara.
You're very welcome. Today we've been talking with Damon Motsturi, clean energy organizer for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Dr. Pat DeLaQuille with 350 PDX. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG. GLPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll be rerunning the interview I did a few weeks ago with Pete Erickson, who's with the Stockholm Environment Institute, and it'll be a lot about actual factual analysis of the supplemental environmental impact statement for the Klamath Methanol Refinery. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music for tomorrow. It's Mardi Gras, so we're going to hear from the Wild Chapultepec. Thanks for listening.
Rulers on the holiday.